LegalizeFreedom.com. Why are we here? Where do we come from? Where are we going? From the nature of reality to the future of humanity. Beyond politics, poverty, and war. LegalizeFreedom.com.
Greetings and welcome once again to LegalizeFreedom.com. I'm your host Greg Moffat, and my guest today is Simon Powell, who joins us to discuss his book, Darwin's Unfinished Business, The Self-Organizing Intelligence of Nature. Darwin's theory of evolution is undoubtedly one of the most important scientific ideas of the modern age, explaining the existence of both life and consciousness without recourse to divine intervention. Yet how do we interpret evolution? How do we evaluate the ability of nature to engineer something as exquisite as the genetic code or the human brain? Could it be that evolution is an intelligent process? According to most scientists, the answer is no. While humanity may be intelligent and purposeful, the natural processes that crafted us are deemed to be devoid of such attributes. In a radical move away from orthodoxy, Simon Powell extends Darwin's vision by showing that evolution is not just about the survival of the fittest, but rather the survival of clever and sensible behaviour. Revealing the importance of the context in which things evolve, he explores the intelligent learning process behind natural selection. Rich with examples of the incredibly complex plants, animals, insects, and marine life designed by nature, he shows nature as a whole to be a system of self-organizing intelligence in which life and consciousness are always destined to emerge. Examining the origins of life and the failure of artificial intelligence to compete with natural intelligence, he explains how our scientifically narrow-minded views on intelligence are now acting as a barrier to our own evolution. As Darwin's unfinished business comes to light and nature's intelligence is embraced, we learn that nature's agenda is not simply the replication of genetic matter, but of expanding consciousness. By working with nature's creative and innovative powers instead of against them, we can address today's social and environmental challenges with a new green science of evolution. Hello and welcome, Simon. Thank you so much for joining us today on LegalizeFreedom.com.
Yeah, cheers. Thanks for having me.
Now, Simon, today I'm going to talk to you a little bit about a book you published a couple of years ago, Darwin's Unfinished Business, The Self-Organizing Intelligence of Nature. Before we get into that, just tell listeners a little bit about your background and how you became interested in this area in the first place.
Well, then I'll have to be honest about that. And the main catalyst behind my thinking and my interest in life on Earth and my different interpretation of life on Earth, my unorthodox interpretation of life, because the Darwin's Unfinished Business talks about evolving life being an intelligence, that life is a kind of intelligence unto itself. What inspired that kind of unorthodox approach and that unorthodox interpretation was undoubtedly my use of psilocybin mushrooms, which grow in the UK and which I've made use of for over 25 years now, and they acted as a kind of catalyst for new ways of thinking, I suppose. I mean, the old adage that psychedelics like psilocybin can expand the mind, I found that to be the case, and I found that I was perceiving and conceiving of nature and life in an unorthodox a way that's different to conventional, let's say, the conventional scientific approach. So from my 25 years of psilocybin use, and I'm still here, this natural, what I call the natural intelligence paradigm came out of that. It's the fruit of all my various experiences and adventures going around the wilderness parts of the UK, picking this mushroom and enjoying them around a campfire and contemplating the splendid spectacle of life on Earth, and particularly our conscious role within life on Earth. So psilocybin had a great part to play in my thinking, But I graduated, I studied psychology at university, graduated with a psychology degree, but that was as far as my academic interests. I'm not connected to any academic institutions now. So I'm like a freelance researcher, I suppose.
I had a similar experience. I've not eaten so-called popular name for them as magic mushrooms for many years, but I had a very similar experience, and it becomes self-evident, I think. By no means do people have to come to this realization through psychedelics, but going that route, the intelligence in the wider world, in nature itself, it does become self-evident. It's kind of like, of course, it seems so obvious. And in fact, I remember as a child, I had a great interest in plants, particularly growing fruit and veg from, you know, when I was very young. I'm not quite sure why, I just had it. But it seemed to me, before anyone told me different, that there was intelligence and purpose everywhere, because I looked at the, you know, the plants and the fruits thereof, and the complexity and the diversity. It seemed to me crazy that it would be anything other than an intelligent process at work there, however you define intelligence. And of course, that's a big point you make in your book.
But I mean, you get that. That's totally understandable. There's a sense, and you get this with psilocybin, that there's a, I suppose if you boil it down, there's some sort of wisdom or way, a wise way to life on Earth and to the rest of nature, and that there is some kind of, I mean, teleology, the idea that there is purpose within, that the universe has a function or nature has some kind of function. It might be anathema to scientists, but I think it's got a lot going for it, the idea there's some kind of purpose and that life and consciousness are fulfilling some kind of long-term function or purpose. And you do, that does seem to, I think it's quite, that's quite a common perception under the influence of psychedelics.
And when we start to talk about intelligence and indeed a degree of design, we're not talking about intelligent, we'll come on to this later, but we're not talking about intelligent design per se as it's currently bandied about, but you're postulating basically that evolution, it clearly happens. I don't think anyone can look at the world and say that nothing has ever evolved. We didn't all just arrive in 7 days, or was it 6 days and one day off? Can't quite remember. But that the idea of dumb, unintelligent nature doesn't account for what we see. You know, the aforementioned complexity and diversity, and the idea that all of this arose randomly from mud, basically for no reason. I mean, the odds of that are extreme. And as you point out, context is everything. That's a thread running right throughout your book.
Well, context, you can expand. Context also includes the laws of nature. You need a certain, in order to get life and consciousness, you need, you know, precise kind of Lego bricks. You need a very, very highly specific kind of universe for life to, to have a self-organizing universe in which life naturally forms, naturally arises where conditions are fitting for it. It's the whole system has got to be kind of, it's intelligently configured, but the intelligence is in the whole system. Well, I don't know if you want to talk about the intelligent design thing yet, because that's like the bane of my work, is to be confused with the intelligent design movement.
Well, I mean, we're going to get to it sooner or later. So just we can set out basically why what you're talking about is not intelligent design as put forward by moderately reformed creationists.
Yeah. Well, but the difference between the natural intelligence paradigm and intelligent design creationism is that intelligent design creationism, they see the they're invoking some kind of supernatural intelligence. There's something outside of nature, whatever that means to be outside of nature, that can manipulate and step in and tinker around, which is good. It's theistic. It's the idea of a God existing outside of nature. Whereas I suppose the natural intelligence paradigm is more pantheistic in that it sees intelligence as being integral to nature itself. It's not a supernatural intelligence, it's a natural intelligence. So when I talk about life, evolving life being an intelligence, I mean life itself is an intelligence. And when you look down at a microscope, at a cell, and you're looking at all these self-organizing molecular processes, that is the intelligence that you're looking at. The intelligence is embodied in the specific behavior of chemicals and molecules. So that it's not an external intelligence. Life itself is an intelligence, and it arises because the larger system that provokes, evokes, and nourishes life, the larger system being nature and the laws of nature and the forces of nature, there's some kind of intelligence in that as well. But it's not supernatural, it's nature itself. And it's autonomous. It's an autonomous intelligence that is nature. Nature is a naturally intelligent system that provokes naturally intelligent processes like evolution.
Now, one thing that I've been puzzling over all my life, and a lot of other people have been as well, is just literally the origin of life itself. You know, is it ex nihilo, from nothing? How is that possible? The origin and function of consciousness. Is consciousness actually the ground of being? You know, is it that the background from which everything else arises? On and on and on, endless questions, very few answers. And you basically postulate that you can explain life and consciousness as a byproduct of evolution. Now, I'm still kind of unsure about that, but in what sense does the intelligent process that you've identified explain the origin of life and consciousness?
Well, they are big and difficult questions, and I don't think anyone's got answers. We're still, it's possible nobody so far has understood what's actually going on. You know, you can confidently say that something is going on. The fact that we exist and we're conscious, and you know, is this been this 3.8 billion years of evolution that's led to conscious beings like us? You can confidently say there's something going on, but I don't think anybody really knows what's going on. Evolution of the human nervous system, that's what's facilitated. I think consciousness was always poised to emerge, given the right, or the consciousness of the kind we have. And it just requires the right neurological conditions, I suppose. Once a nervous system has evolved a certain degree of complexity, then it then can facilitate consciousness. So I see it. My impression, my current sort of metaphysical notion, is that there's some kind of, I don't know whether you'd call it a being or beingness, there's some kind of, it's like a very gradual awakening process, that something is in the process of waking up to itself. And that would equate to that nature, through consciousness, nature is waking up to itself and is becoming aware of itself. And the way I put that in the natural intelligence paradigm is that natural intelligence is waking up to itself. So I think that's what consciousness is, but we're at a very early stage of that process. So we haven't realized yet what we are and what consciousness is, that it can fulfill a function. And so something is waking up through the vehicle of consciousness, if you like, and that had to happen. It's a natural process, and I think there are large cosmic cycles, and I'm drawn towards Hindu sort of mythological ideas of large cosmic cycles of sleep and awakening, and that's what I think is going on. There's some kind of creative awakening process. It's like something it constantly destroys itself and then builds itself together again.
Yes, you're referring to the Hindu idea there. I'm thinking about the yugas, you know, the 24,000 year cycle. I've done at least one show on that, and I'm always sort of, I find myself daydreaming, veering between the appeal of that idea, but also the feeling that we are actually part of a linear process. So on any given day, I can find either one of those ideas sort of appealing, yeah, in terms of what the bigger picture might be.
Yeah, but my point is that consciousness is the way nature or the universe is making sense of itself and waking up to itself, and it's a natural process. It's kind of it's built in, that this facility, the fact that there are the specific forces of nature and the specific laws of nature and the Lego-like building blocks of nature, and the fact that life will fall into place and it will evolve and then consciousness will come into play. The whole thing is a natural creative process, in the same way an oak tree is inherent in an acorn. You know, given time, an acorn will transform itself into an oak tree. It's the same, I think, with the evolution of life. It had to happen, and so it must be fulfilling some cosmic function, if you like. Where that will lead, if you follow the notion of teleology, well, then you come to Teilhard de Chardin's notion of an omega point, that at some point in the distant future, I don't know, conscious intelligence will become divine.
Well, there's the argument as well with regard to consciousness that it doesn't serve an evolutionary function. Now, of course, in the scenario you portray, it most certainly would. But there's also, it's worth bearing in mind that you can make the case that we would be, as a species, we would be better off if we just did the four Fs. What is it? Fighting, fleeing, feeding, and fornicating, basically. And if we didn't have this intelligent consciousness, because it's actually proving to be a threat to our own survival and that of a lot of life on the planet. So if we really were just like the rest of the apes, if we assume that we are actually evolved apes, you know, this highly developed consciousness that we have wouldn't serve any function. We'd be much better without it from one point of view.
Yeah, but there are different degrees of consciousness. You know, there are different states of consciousness. I mean, you can have, you know, you can have healthy states of consciousness, and you can have unhealthy states of consciousness. So there, it's consciousness is mutable. I mean, consciousness is fundamental, because it's all we, you touched on it earlier. It's some kind of fundamental thing, consciousness. And you can't really get away from that, because the only thing you know, one knows, is one's conscious experience. So it's more fundamental than matter when you think about it, because matter is an idea within consciousness. So it's fundamental and it's essential and it's there. But the important thing, given what you said about how destructive we can be, is there are different, consciousness is mutable, and there are different states of consciousness. And there's a good case to be made that we operate in a very low state of consciousness most of the time. And all these teachers, spiritual teachers, I'm thinking of Gurdjieff and Krishnamurti and Eckhart Tolle and Buddhism, all those kind of teachings that teach mindfulness, they're really teaching how to, they're talking about the management of consciousness and how to sort of galvanize higher states of consciousness, and that's a good thing.
Speaking about different degrees of consciousness, I think people could agree that, for example, their pets are conscious, you know, a cat and a dog, horse, parrots, or whatever it happens to be. I think people get that. These are conscious creatures who can feel, perhaps not the depth of feeling that we do, which we just don't know. But when that crosses over into the plant world, and I know that you're talking about evolution in the wider sense, but this is actually very important, the idea that there is intelligence everywhere. And the important distinction you make is that intelligence does not need to be conscious as such.
Yeah.
And when you allow that, then it really opens up into seeing intelligence in wider nature.
Yeah, it's a two-edged sword, this idea. I remember when I first started thinking about it, I thought, well, some people will be offended by the notion that say a plant is an embodiment of unconscious intelligence. Some people might be, you know, be cheesed off with that, but I don't think you need to be cheesed off with it. It's important to differentiate between consciousness and intelligence, because normally this whole thing, intelligence is a taboo word these days, because we tend to associate it with just us. You know, humans are intelligent. And so when you start talking about plant intelligence and such, it can cause a furore. And I think it's part of the problem is that we associate intelligence with consciousness. And so we think of conscious intelligence, but there can be unconscious intelligence. So my argument that I make in Darwin's Unfinished Business, or when I talk about life being an intelligence, think about, I don't know, bacteria or fungi or plants. I'm saying that the biologic of which they consist, I'm saying that's an unconscious intelligence, and that intelligence goes through phases, and it's when it gets complex enough, or it's got the right conditions and the right kind of nervous system and the right kind of information, that I might, the right amount of deep enough resolution, as it were, then it becomes intelligence can become conscious. But yeah, it's very important to grasp the natural intelligence paradigm as I propound it. It's important to be able to conceive that intelligence can be unconscious. I mean, we can do that with artificial intelligence. If you see a very clever robot that can do very, like the Mars rovers, for example, that can navigate new terrains and they can sustain themselves and carry out smart processes. Nobody's saying they're conscious. You know, intelligence is really a kind of a behavior, a sensible, clever behavior. And, you know, plants exhibit that they behave in a clever and sensible way, but it doesn't have to be conscious. And I think once you can grok the notion that intelligence can be unconscious, then you can see life itself as an unconscious intelligence, and that the whole universe is a kind of unconscious. This relates to what I was saying earlier, to these Hindu ideas, that the universe itself is a kind of unconscious intelligence that's gradually becoming more, will become more and more conscious as time goes on.
Although I had those experiences as a child that I mentioned earlier about sort of seeing intelligence everywhere and seeing, you know, life as an integrated whole, the penny really dropped for me, and you mentioned this in your book, was a television series called The Secret Life of Plants.
Yeah.
And, but was it 1990 or was it sometime about, like, quite a long time ago anyway, and I'm sure people can find this online now, but when I saw that time-lapse photography,
yeah,
it was like, that was a definite turning point.
That was about 1996, I think, 1997. David, you're talking about the David Attenborough series?
Yeah, that's the one, yeah.
Yeah, the time, yeah, I mean, it was very psychedelic. It was amazing because it's stuff like that. That's the first time, I think it was probably one of the first times they'd ever, because they had the equipment, you need to develop the equipment to do that kind of thing. It was one of the first times they used time-lapse, you know, stunning time-lapse to see plants, plant tendrils moving around, you know, finding things to grip and to grow on and stuff. Yeah, that left a big impression on me as well. Yeah, I think I briefly mentioned it in Darwin's Unfinished Business. But yeah, it's interesting that you need this human intelligence applied to technology can then reveal the natural intelligence of, in this case, plants.
Now, looking at evolution, one of the reasons why certain people have been tempted to attribute no intelligence to any of the processes is it's extremely slow. Millions of years, many, many millions of years have brought us to where we are now. And you mentioned Ray Kurzweil, the well-known sort of transhumanist advocate. But I think that you basically said how you completely disagree with his perspective. And I have to agree with you as well that it puts things overly in a humanistic perspective. Like everything has to be judged on our sort of time scales.
Our standards.
Yeah, very much so. And it reminds me, when I was reading your section, when you're talking about his ideas, refuting them basically, I was reminded of the Ents in Lord of the Rings, you know, sort of like how there's a different way to do things. Everything doesn't have to be done quickly, nor on a human timescale.
Yeah, well, that's the other thing about the intelligence of life. It's very slow, but I mean, who's to life? It's got all the time, and nature's got all the time in the world and all the energy in the world. So, you know, who's counting? But the example I give, the Ray Kurzweil thing. I think I quoted him is something he wrote a long time ago. He was talking about the IQ. Of evolution and saying it was just above zero or something silly like that, and I just criticized that, saying it was ridiculous to try and to talk about the intelligence of evolving life in human terms and IQ terms. And the example I always give, if you want to pursue the IQ thing, because we always associate, often people think of intelligence, they think of IQ tests and stuff, if a 6 month old child got full marks in an IQ test by some honest means, but took 6 months to get a maximum score, we wouldn't ignore the child on the grounds that it took 6 months, would we? Are we stupid? The child's obviously a prodigy. And anyone who ignored that child just because they dismissed it, say, well, it took 6 months to get this maximum score, you know, they'd be stupid. Duration doesn't matter. What matters is the nature of the process and what is being achieved with that process. And so, yes, evolution takes, millions of years, but that's the way life works, you know. Intelligence doesn't have to be on our timescales. There can be, you know, intelligence operating over millions. What's important with evolution are the specific changes to genes that occur over millions of years. It's all very specific. What nature preserves. Nature preserves again and again and again specific changes to DNA. Those specific changes that lead to some kind of sensible life-affirming behavior. And then when you look at the entire series of changes, that's when you start to divine the intelligence. It's information gaining intelligence. DNA is an informational system. Information is being manipulated over time. The whole thing is a natural intelligence. I'm convinced of it. Thinking about it again now, I'm reconvincing myself of it. But so it takes time, but it doesn't matter. What matters is the nature of the process and the information, the specific kind of information processing, because DNA is digital. This is another thing people probably don't reflect on. You know, DNA is an actual digital code. We always think of digital codes, you know, we think of binary computer code and we think of human technology and computers and stuff. Life is based on DNA and the genetic code, which is digital. You know, there are four kinds of nucleotides. So it's quaternary rather than binary, but it's a digital code. And so life is digital information processing over large periods of time.
I think we miss a lot and we lose a lot in life, really, by putting everything on human timescales. I mean, I live in a city here with a cathedral that took, I sometimes pause to think about this when I'm walking past, it took hundreds of years to build. The men, and it would have been men and probably boys, who started to build that knew they would never see it complete, but still they spent their lives working on it. Yeah. And it's something we seem incapable of doing now, really, is you know, putting things, zooming out into see things in a bigger picture.
Yeah. Well, yeah, it's important to do that. I mean, that's another thing I tend to bang on about is that we need to. I've got this new book coming out in January. That's about psilocybin again. But I've got about 20,000 words of notes for a fourth book I'm going to write. And one of the title I'm playing with at the moment is Transcension. And transcension is the act of transcending. And I think we just need to. You're talking about the bigger picture, that we need to grasp the bigger picture and see the larger whole of which we're all a part and stuff. We need to basically transcend our current concepts. We really need to take a new step forward, and all things like flag waving and, you know, the sense that we need to transcend our sense of identity rather than thinking you're British or you're French or you're a Jew or you're a Palestinian or you're an Arab or all this kind of stuff. We're all humans, you know, we all exist together on the same, within the same biosphere, which is our shared home. And so it's which is part of this evolving cosmos. And we need to expand our minds, and if we don't, you don't have to do that through psilocybin, but we need new concepts and stuff to enable us to transcend our current, to evolve. You know, everything changes and evolves, so we need to get wise to the bigger picture, particularly to the biosphere, because our shared home, the biosphere, is we're at a critical juncture of human history now with, you know, 7 billion people and the, you know, global warming and stuff. All the infighting's got to stop. We need to start cooperating as a global species within us and realize that the biosphere is our single shared home, and we need to be sharing resources, and we need to be developing long-term thinking in order to create a sustainable future.
Yeah, so we certainly could do with being a bit more humble, couldn't we? And I mean, I mentioned earlier, in the context of Ray Kurzweil, the transhumanist ideas, I think in some ways a lot of the stuff we hear talked about technology and where that's going to take us is kind of misleading, I don't have great hopes for any of the transhumanist ideas, and I think they're misunderstanding what it is to be human in a way. You know, spending the one life they have, unless you want to get into sort of Vedic ideas and reincarnation, but spending the one life they have trying to outlive, you know, what their natural span, and it really does miss what being human is. I mean, for me, being human, and again, it goes back to what I was saying a moment ago about perhaps being humble, is to be born basically to love and to die. You know, dying is part of being human, and that doesn't seem to be enough for some people.
Yeah, but I mean, you know, these are difficult. What it is to live, what it is to be born to live and die as a human. I mean, what a trip that is. But yeah, I put my, I don't know if the word hope is there. I put my allegiance with a larger whole. The way I see consciousness and our individual lives, our finite individual human lives, is that what we are, each one of us, is a partial reflection of the whole. And even though we have a limited time span, the whole continues. And so it's very important to develop a right relationship in this life, finite lifetime, with the larger whole. And I tell you, that could mean anything. I'm meaning it that in a kind of spiritual way. But that's the important thing.
Something else I was reminded of when I was reading your book was a book by a guy called Greg Braden. He's quite big on the New Age scene. But that's kind of beside the point. But in one of his books, there was a very detailed breakdown of conception in terms of human reproduction. Now, I'm not a parent, but obviously I know the basics of how conception, pregnancy and childbirth, that works. But when I read it in this broken down form, I had to keep stopping as I was going through it. I was going, this is incredible. It's like, yeah, I sort of knew this, but this is unbelievable almost. The idea, what are the chances of this ever happening? And it was almost a magical process. And in terms of the origin of life, it led me to the thought that life can only come from life. It can't come from something that's either dead or has never been alive. Now, I know that's somewhat beyond the scope of your book, but I don't know what your thoughts on that are, because that takes us to the endless regress, doesn't it, then?
What I'm reminded of, well, it is in a way. I have written about this in a way, but you're saying life needs to come from life. Well, I'm saying that life is as an intelligence, and I say in the book, intelligence begets intelligence. You need intelligence of one form to beget intelligence of another form. Life is an intelligence that's emerged out of, life is a natural intelligence that's emerged out of a naturally intelligent universe. So you need intelligence in one form, in this case the whole system of nature, in particular the laws of nature and the forces of nature, and as I said before, the Lego-like building blocks of nature. That itself is a kind of intelligence that then provokes life, which is a kind of intelligence which can then facilitate conscious intelligence which we enjoy. So although I don't talk about life needs to come from life, what I do talk about is that intelligence in any form, and don't forget I'm saying that life is a kind of intelligence, it needs intelligence of another form to beget it. So there's always been an intelligence in some kind of form, and that gets back to these ancient kind of Hindu ideas again. There's always been, so you can't have, you know, it's a trendy thing at the moment amongst physicists like Lawrence Krauss to sort of come up with statements like the universe from nothing, and people flock around him. Well, tell us, Lawrence, tell us how it all comes out of nothing. Do you really mean everything came out of nothing? Yes, there was absolutely nothing, and then there was something. You know, he talks about nothing. It's not nothing at all. It's some kind of quantum flux or something. You know, it's very far from nothing. So there's always been, and there must have always been a potential there. The universe started, and so before, whatever that means, before the universe, there had to have been the potential for a universe. And a potential is something. It's not nothing. In fact, it's the biggest potential one can imagine, because the whole universe, including us, came out of it. So there's always been something, even if it was just a potential. And so I think there's always been intelligence in one form or another. So you said you think life came from life, I think is what you said. There must have been life in order to life. Well, I'm saying that life is an intelligence. And so move aside the word life for the time being and just think of intelligence. And that intelligence can manifest in different ways, in different systems, and in different substrates, and have different qualities. I'm saying that intelligence always existed. So I think that ties in with what you said.
Well, at this point, we should wheel out the quote from Carl Sagan that you have in the book. In order to make a simple apple pie, first you must invent the universe.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, you need the whole... It's a system thing. It's all connected. Everything's interconnected, and it's all part of one system. And so there's always been something. I think there's always been a principle of intelligence of some kind.
Speaking once again about context, and this is a real eye-opener for people who haven't come across this train of thought before, you talk about the computer simulation to recreate the evolution of the eye. Now, the human eye was something, and indeed, eyes in animals, fish, birds, whatever it happens to be, was something that Darwin puzzled over. You know, he was sort of thinking, how could something like this have arisen through the process of evolution? And I was speaking to someone about this the other day, and I mentioned this eye, the evolution of the eye, and this person said, oh yeah, I think that's been disproved. I mean, they've run a computer simulation. But what people are forgetting there is that, okay, they're running a computer simulation. A computer is a form of intelligence. Who designed the computer? Who built the computer? Who wrote the software? It's all intelligence. So that the eye program, so to speak, doesn't necessarily show us that the eye could evolve, as a random process, purposeless process from the proverbial primordial soup.
Well, yeah, I go into this. There's a chapter in that in Darwin's Unfinished Business about genetic algorithms, is what we're really talking about. And genetic algorithms are interesting because you can run simulations of evolution on a computer, and you can evolve very interesting things like a basic eye, or you can evolve software and stuff that an individual human programmer couldn't come up with. So genetic algorithms are interesting because they facilitate virtual evolutionary processes, if you like. But yeah, you can't. It still needs intelligence because the hardware and the software embody intelligence from they're a reflection of human intelligence. So applying that to the evolution of life, you need a naturally intelligent system within which evolution can proceed, and that is the universe itself is this naturally intelligent context or system that facilitates self-organization and creative processes, and so life and consciousness don't emerge out of nothing. They emerge out of this naturally intelligent system we call nature. And I think a lot of scientists, they grasp this because there's been a trend over the last, 50 years or so, particularly over the last 20 years, to invoke multiple universes. Scientists realize that the laws of nature and the forces of nature are very specific, and that we live in a very fine-tuned universe, and rather than seeing the universe as kind of an intelligence and adopting a pantheistic approach, they come up with multiple universe scenarios. So there's some kind of mechanism that churns out an infinite amount of universes, and if you've got an infinite amount of universes being churned out, some of them will be conducive to life. But then if you then pose the difficult question, well, where did this mechanism come from that's churning out these infinite, well, then you have to pass the buck again and say there must be an infinity of possible mechanisms, and blah blah blah. You just keep, so it shows that kind of trend now to go down the multiple universe thing, which just passes the buck. That shows that highlights how we do live in a very significant universe. And I say it's a naturally intelligent universe.
People often like to make comparisons between the human brain, the computing power thereof, and that of the very latest microprocessors. there's some people, depending on which side of the fence they're on, some people are saying that's just around the corner. Any minute now, the power of artificial intelligence will outstrip that of human intelligence. But I think that everywhere you look in that area, we're coming up against barriers, and that there are a lot of false hopes for artificial intelligence, as you talk about in the book, and it comes from this fundamental misunderstanding of what intelligence is. I can't remember the name of it, but there's a recently in the news, there was a computer somewhere in, I think it might even be in Ukraine of all places, that had been deemed to have crossed an important threshold because it had been able to fool some online people who are interacting with it.
Turing test. It passed the Turing.
That's the very one. But as I pointed out, I mean, if you say to that computer, I love you, if it says, I love you too, does it, quote unquote, understand? And that's been my beef with artificial intelligence. The idea that computers can number crunch all day long, and God knows what the potential will be if we get into quantum computing. But what's the question of meaning? And that's, you know, what human life is all about, meaning and understanding. And I don't think, you know, in that sense, artificial intelligence doesn't understand anything.
Well, it would have to be, at times when I've thought about this, a conscious AI, now I'm talking about, not an unconscious artificial intelligence, a conscious AI would have to be born. It would have to be born, I think, like a human is born. It would have to be immersed in sensible information, just like a baby and a child is immersed in sensible information. It would have to be born. You'd have to mimic. I don't know if anyone's looking into that. It's not a subject I research and stuff. But I wonder if there are any of these research AI, these people interested in these kind of conscious computers, Cyberdyne systems or whatever. I wonder if they've looked into how you could, it would have to mimic. I mean, in what I'm interested in, natural intelligence, the biomimicry movement interests me because they're specifically about consciously emulating nature's genius. So you look to nature for solutions to various, you know, sort of engineering problems and stuff. Well, I would have thought you could use that biomimicry approach to creating an artificial consciousness, if you like, and so you'd have to mimic what it is to be a human, the way a human is born and how it goes through childhood and develops. It would have to be like that. I don't know if anyone's doing that in the computer field.
Oh, part of me says I sincerely hope not, but it wouldn't surprise me. There's a section in the book, most interesting, where you talk about symbiosis with reference to flowering plants and fruit. Now, I will just refer listeners, if they're interested in more in this area, I did an interview with a chap called Tony Wright, who talks a great deal about our relationship with fruit and how important that was in our evolution and development, and how actually it's to our detriment now that we've lost that connection.
I'm very interested in symbiosis because it's a very important principle. I'm of the opinion that the biomimicry people are on the right track, and we need to be learning from nature because nature has had millions of years to solve all these problems of how to live and be. And so there is a wisdom to life, and we can learn from life. And one not just like, for instance, Dave, if you want to, this is just a typical example of the biomimicry movement. If engineers are interested in the difficult problem of how to create a glue that works underwater, you know, that's a difficult thing. They're creating a glue that will work in watery conditions. You know, you can look at how barnacles adhere to rocks and stuff underwater. So you can look to nature look at what molecules and proteins and stuff various organisms are using. But not only can we learn individual things like that, I think we need to be learning principles, and symbiosis is an essential life principle that's it's undersung, and it needs to be, you know, a lot of people don't know really what symbiosis is. It's not I never heard about it when I was at school. A symbiosis is, you know, species working together. So for instance, the flowering plants and say bees that pollinate them, that's a a symbiosis, and the genes within bees that get them, that govern flower seeking behavior, only make sense. Those bee genes only make sense in the context of the genes of these plants that produce flowers, and vice versa. So it's a symbiosis is a holistic thing. It's a system thing. And it's crucial for life on Earth. I mean, symbiosis is every, it's in our cells. I mean, you think about energy production in our cells. It's what controls that. Our mitochondria, they're like the powerhouses of cells, referred to as midi-chlorians in the Star Wars movies. And mitochondria have their own DNA, which is interesting. So in every one of your cells, you've got these mitochondria, and they've got their own DNA. It's distinct from your human DNA. And they've got their own DNA because they used to be separate living organisms. So the same with chloroplasts inside plants that carry out photosynthesis. They also have their own DNA. And they were once separate living organisms. So take coral, for example. That's a symbiotic union of a polyp and an algae. So that's a symbiosis. Lichen that you find on rocks is a symbiosis. It's a fungus and an algae living tightly together. So symbiosis is an essential principle of life. What I'm trying to say is that symbiosis is an essential principle of life on Earth, and we would do well to take note of it and act in a symbiotic way with the rest of the biosphere, because at the moment we're more like parasites as opposed to being symbiotic with the rest of the web of life. We're like a leech, you know, that just takes and takes and takes and doesn't regenerate. So we need to, if we have to have a sustainable culture, we have to be more regenerative, and we have to act in a symbiotic way.
I mean, thinking back to someone like Rudolf Steiner, his ideas about permaculture and learning from nature, that seems, even to some people looking at it today, quite radical, but it's really about relearning things that we have forgotten. So you're quite right to say that we need to be operating as a species and as we interact with the rest of nature in more cooperative mode. But you know, this is something, that an understanding that we have lost, so we can get back to this. It is the natural way of being.
Yeah. Well, permaculture is quite popular now. I've been contacted by permaculture people that like my work. So it's the wisdom is there. I mean, like, you know, life's been going for sustainability is a buzzword. You know, it's been a buzzword for about 5, 6, 7 years now. Sustainability. But life itself has learned the art of sustainability. Rainforests last for millions and millions and millions of years, and they don't need, you know, rainforests don't need humans to you know, with clipboards and white lab coats walking around, you know, making sure it works all right. It works on its own. Nature works because there's a wisdom to life, and there's a wisdom to the way the symbiotic nature of life, the interrelationships, and, you know, output of one species is input for another species, and it's all linked together, and, you know, you've got different specializations. And so life itself, because it's a natural intelligence, has already learned the art of sustainability. So if we are to be a sustainable species within the biosphere, we have to play by the same rules.
Well, I think due to various reasons connected with you know, how we derive our energy for industrial civilization, etc., maybe not in our lifetimes, I don't think, but maybe 100, 200 years from now, I think we'll be living like we did in the quite distant past. Things will certainly be in more of a balance then, simply because they have to be. They're well out of whack now. And nature, which is what we've been talking about, always finds that balance and equilibrium. You know, if there's a problem somewhere, too much of something, nature finds a way to bring it back into balance, you know, and sometimes that can be painful for the species involved.
Well, nature prunes, the hand of nature prunes that which, the way I sum it up in my book is that, you know, there's this old this old Darwin never said it, but you still hear people talking about the survival of the fittest. Darwin actually never said that. He talked about the survival of the most adaptable. But there's this pop meme that the survival of the fittest, you know, that's what evolution is about. It's not. Evolution is about the survival of that which makes sense. Sensible, life-affirming behavior is what the hand of nature will select. Anything else will be eventually be pruned, which means, you know, death. It won't carry on. And it's the same for the human species. You know, unless we play by the rules I was talking about and we become more symbiotic with the rest of the web of life and we live accordingly, we will not be sustained. We will be pruned. So we have no choice, really. And, you know, this is the age in which we live. We've reached this important, with global warming, we've reached this juncture now where we have to, which is why I think it's very important to reassess our relationship with nature. I bang on a lot about our relationship. You know, David Attenborough, who made that Private Life of Plants series, you know, he's been interviewed recently and people are asking him what's the thing he's most concerned with. And he says it's our mankind's disconnect from nature. And it is, because most of us live in cities now. Nature deficit disorder is a very serious thing. And if nature deficit disorder is allowed to continue en masse, then we'll go down the pan. You know, life will carry on, but the human race won't, or it'll be severely curtailed. So our relationship with nature is a very important thing. And, you know, getting back to how we started with psilocybin, I mean, psilocybin is a natural, it's produced in these mushrooms naturally in the UK. You know, it's part of the wilderness heritage of the UK. And it is like a sort of a medicine that's being produced there, and it can reconnect. You know, it's an eco-psychological catalyst, and it can reconnect us to nature. And we need to be reconnected to nature. And you were mentioning transhumanism or whatever. The problem with that is it's a long way from nature. It's almost like the people are saying, well, nature's boring and we understand life now, and, you know, life's just DNA and variation and natural selection. It's not. It's an actual – life is a technology. Life is a natural technology, a nanotechnology when you look at the scale that it's on. And more impressive – it's more impressive than human technology. Like you said, the – stuff you were reading about embryology and how, you know, reproduction and all this kind of thing. Life is a natural, highly sophisticated technology, but we've yet to acknowledge that it's a technology. It's like the word technology is the same as intelligence, and we reserve it for ourselves. So when you think of intelligence, design, and technology, you think, well, it's humans. Humans design, humans are intelligent, humans make technology. But life itself is a natural technology, it's a natural intelligence, and it's redolent in natural design. And it's high time we started to appreciate that and acknowledge that and learn from that.
Well, beyond even human reproduction, I mean, you give some good examples in the book. You know, everyday examples that people will be familiar with, ants. You know, ant colonies, bees, their behavior in and outside of the hive. And people will say, oh, yeah, I know they're complex sort of societies that they have, you know, quote unquote, developed. But when you look at it in a little more detail, it's astounding, absolutely astounding. And I always like to, whenever I can, it doesn't happen very often, but give a shout out for one of my favorite films. If you haven't seen it, you've got to see it. It's called Phase 4. It's about some ants basically getting the better of some human scientists. And, it's not big on the sort of car chases and sex scenes, but it's an amazing film.
Well, yeah, talking about amazing things, the other day I was eating, you know, strawberry season. I was eating a strawberry and I was just looking at this, you know, it's one of the only fruit, if not the only fruit, that's got the seeds on the outside. And I was looking at these tiny little seeds on the surface of a strawberry. And I was thinking that there's information in that seed to make new plants. There's information in there on how to grow, you know, roots, shoots, leaves, you know, photosynthetic nanotechnology, and to grow more strawberries. So when you look at a strawberry seed and you realize the potential that's in there, the specific information that's in a strawberry seed, this library of information, it's got like a fractal. It's like a fractal, because you start thinking about it and there's this fractal. It's like it's kind of a, like a fractal intelligence, you know. But yeah, we take it for granted. It's like we've got a, but then the most important thing are the large scale, the ecosystem services that life affords. You know, it maintains temperature and you know, the salinity of the ocean and the composition of the atmosphere and the sequestration of carbon and all this kind of thing. There are all these massive chemical cycles that life controls and maintains. This ties in with Lovelock's Gaia theory. So it's a life support system, and we don't acknowledge that it's a life support system. So yeah, it's very, our relationship with nature, and it's important to cultivate wonder and to see that, to start thinking that maybe, you know, there are more people, there are papers now being written about the intelligence of plants and stuff, for example. So it's kind of, there's a growing awareness that we've still a lot to learn about life, and that the way I put it is, the closer we look at life, the more does natural intelligence become apparent. It's like it's so smart, life, that we haven't grasped it all yet. And that the closer you look, the more closely you examine life, the smarter it is. And so we really have to get down off the pedestal, and human intelligence has to acknowledge that natural intelligence is superior. That human intelligence only exists because there's a huge pyramid of natural intelligence that's underlying it.
Yeah, you only have to look out at the world really today, what's going on in Gaza, what's been going on in Ukraine. Everywhere you look, it's like, oh yeah, that's really smart. That's really intelligent. No, I don't realize that it's a relatively small number of human beings causing all this mayhem. But the upshot of it is that it's the what looms largest on the world stage. Not all the good things being done at various levels. You know, we do see that mode of consciousness, that negativity does dominate.
Yeah, it's very important that we begin to... Consciousness is a very interesting thing, because when it's at a low, you know, for instance, negative emotions and hatred and violence and anger and all this kind of thing, they can't operate when consciousness is clearer and... Gurdjieff used to talk about that man was asleep and mechanical, the thing to do is to wake up. And I think all these spiritual teachers that teach mindfulness in one way or another, it's a good thing, because the more mindful you are, the less prone you are to all the shit and negativity that can infect consciousness and corrupt it, you know. So consciousness is a very interesting thing. Even just by talking about consciousness kind of boosts it. But traditionally, people don't talk about consciousness. It's one of those, I've said somewhere, it's like, or someone else said it actually, that consciousness is just in the same way a fish can't really discover water because they're in it all the time. We find it difficult to discover consciousness because we're conscious to some degree all the time. But consciousness can be talked about, and when it is talked about, there are more healthy forms of consciousness and less healthy forms of consciousness. There are higher, more clear forms of consciousness and worse forms of consciousness. And it's very important that we find ways to cultivate higher consciousness. And that's where I suppose new ideas and new concepts come in, because they're connected to, I don't know what you'd call it, expanded states of consciousness or whatever. Consciousness means literally knowing together. That's what the root word means. Con is together. The other consciousness is to do with science, knowing. So consciousness means knowing together. So the more highest, more consciousness means knowing more together, that more, a bigger picture forms. Fitting all the concepts and information together to see the larger whole, and then thereby getting a bigger perspective. That's a good thing. You know, panning back from the earth and seeing, you know, all these borders that people fight about and the flag waving. You know, you're up in space. There are no fucking borders on the planet. You know, it's one biosphere. They're all man-made, all these flags and borders and stuff. That's one system. It's one biosphere. So Yeah, we need new forms of consciousness.
Well, in terms of the natural world, there's magic everywhere. So anytime I hear anyone claim to be bored, they really need to get over themselves. But
yeah,
as you point out, how we judge nature or even evolution as a process affects how we think about life and if indeed life has any meaning. And that then affects how we live life and treat other living beings. And that's really at the root of what we're talking about here. And of course, those more metaphysical questions are ignored by science, which just likes to cut things up and stick them in petri dishes and under microscopes and all the rest of it. But of course, the idea of talking about evolution as somehow purposeful or to have meaning, that for a lot of people are uneasy about that, because as we talked earlier with intelligent design, it opens the door to God. In some people's minds, it does anyway. And you quote Richard Dawkins quite a bit in your book as an example of the sort of counter reaction to that. But really, if we can, I always knew when I was thinking, you know, early on in life, was doing biology at high school, thinking about evolution, thinking about the idea that God made everything in a week. And I knew that there had to be some synthesis somewhere. And that's what I think your book's very good on. Because as I mentioned earlier with my childhood experience with plants, I saw intelligence and design. I will use those two words together. I saw intelligence and saw design everywhere in everything.
Yeah, natural intelligence and natural design, as opposed to supernatural intelligence and supernatural design. So yeah, you saw intelligence and design within life, because there is intelligence and design, but it's natural. It's not supernatural. It's not that there's something existing outside of nature that's pulling all the strings. That intelligence is inherent to nature itself. So it's more of a pantheistic notion. That intelligence is inherent to life. But yeah, there are two. It's almost the way I put it is that there's a pendulum has been swinging from, you know, hundreds of years ago, that the church and religion was the main kind of force, and then Darwin came along and gave that everybody assumed that God did it. You know, why? You know, the wings of a bird, they're so well designed for flying that God must have done it, like a, you know, in a miraculous ping event, you know, ping, and there were these wings. And then Darwin came along and showed how there was this natural process over time, you know, evolution through natural selection. And so you've got the pendulum has gone from a fundamental kind of religious theistic view, and it's now swung right to the other end, and you've got hardcore atheism, and there is no intelligence, and it's all a big accident, and, you know, blah, blah, blah. I'm trying to find I think the natural intelligence paradigm is a resting point of that pendulum, but it's a difficult position, because I have no peer group. It's a, you know, I'm between a rock and a hard place, because the intelligent design creationists won't like this paradigm, because it doesn't invoke anything supernatural. They really want, I've read a book by one of the leading intelligent design guys, Signature in the Cell, it was called. And he absolutely does not want intelligence to be an intrinsic part of nature. They want a God, this old fashioned, theistic, all powerful, you know, judgmental, manipulating God, sort of out that you can, you know, make prayers to and stuff and petition. It exists outside of nature. They absolutely do not want intelligence to be an intrinsic part of nature. And so you've got that. So they're not, they don't like my natural intelligence paradigm. The hardcore neo-Darwinian, you know, Dawkins and his army, they don't like it, because they don't want to invoke intelligence, and intelligence has associations with, you know, religion. And so it's, I'm trying to carve out an alternative, you know, not a compromise, that's the wrong word, but something that acknowledges the ingenious nature of life, and how something that a paradigm that acknowledges that life, there is a wisdom to life. It's in your body now. It's in our everything that your body's doing. It's a, you know, your digestive system, your blood system, your skin, your everything, your brain, all your organs. The root word of, I learnt this recently, the root word of organ. It comes from the word tool. So, you know, an organism is a collection of highly sophisticated tools. Technology, as I said earlier, life is a technology. So the natural intelligence paradigm is trying to, it's endeavoring to acknowledge that there's a wisdom and intelligence to life, but it's not a supernatural wisdom or intelligence. It's nature itself, life itself, the whole system, the cosmos, is a form of intelligence itself. And so it's an alternative to the other dominant views, if you like.
Well, Simon, as we draw things to a close for today, I'll just remind listeners we've been talking about your book. That's Darwin's Unfinished Business. Subtitle is The Self-Organizing Intelligence of Nature. That's widely available, and I know you've got other publications out there. So perhaps you'd like to share information with folks about that, your website. I know you've got a conference coming up in October, which you're going to be part of. So just share that information, anything else you'd like to put out there.
Well, my website, simongpowell.com. I have another book, an earlier book. The first book I wrote was The Psilocybin Solution. That's about psilocybin mushrooms. I have a new book about psilocybin coming out January next year. A load of stuff on YouTube. If you search for Simon G. Powell on YouTube, I've got two full-length documentaries on there, Mana and Metanoia. And the conference is in the first week of October, I believe. It's called Plant Consciousness. I won't be talking about plant consciousness. I'm going to be talking about plant intelligence. When I said earlier to you that you can differentiate between conscious and intelligence, my talk will be about botanical intelligence, and I'll be making the case that plants are embodiments of it. You know, they behave in a naturally intelligent way. That won't be hard for me to make that case. That's coming up in that's in London somewhere in the first week of October. I'll be putting details on my website. The website of the organisers, I think it's plantconsciousness.com, and they're also on Facebook as well. Yeah, and I'm on Facebook, Simon G. Powell.
Yeah, I'll have a link up to the conference website from your interview page, actually, so folks can go straight there. Well, Simon, thank you so much for joining us today on LegalizeFreedom.com.
Yeah, no problem. I hope I said some interesting things.
Thanks.
Well, folks, that's it for another week. As ever, thank you so much for listening. If you enjoy the show, please check out the website. That's LegalizeFreedom.com, Legalize-Freedom.com, where you'll find an archive of programs offering alternative views on a wide range of topics, including world affairs, politics and economics, science and technology, religion and spirituality, conspiracy, and alternative history. You can also browse and buy a range of books and DVDs from our guests, and if you're feeling generous, make a donation to help keep the site up and running. Until next time, I'm Greg Moffat, and you've been listening to LegalizeFreedom.com.